Welcome to 101 Stage Adaptations. I'm your host, Melissa Schmitz. I'm a theater artist and arts administrator, and I wrote my first stage adaptation when I was 22. Now I'm interviewing playwrights about their own adaptations, their creative process, and how they make it all work. Welcome back, everyone. If you haven't done so already, I hope you are following the show on whatever podcast platform you use. Today is a first for me. I am joined by three guests to talk about their design work, which led to a book, which led to an upcoming museum exhibit. Sybil Wickersheimer's interests span design for live performance, installations, exhibitions, and design for mental health care initiatives. Her foundation as a theatrical set designer led Sybil to co-author the book Scene Shift, U.S. Set Designers in Conversation with scenographer Maureen Weiss, published in August of 2022. The book has been shortlisted for the Prague Quadrennial 2023 Book Award and has inspired a Scene Shift exhibition at the Fisher Museum of Art opening in 2024. Sybil has designed for theatrical stages across the country, including MCC, ACT, Theater for a New Audience, Steppenwolf Theater Company, Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Looking Glass Theater Company, Seattle Rep, Portland Center Stage, and Woolly Mammoth Theater Company. In the LA area, she has designed at the Kirk Douglas, the Geffen Playhouse, South Coast Rep, The Industry, LA, Circle X, A Noise Within, The Actors Gang, and many more. Unique projects have included art installations in several SoCal art galleries, Toy Story the Musical for Disney Cruise Ships, and the stage set for the giant dinosaur puppet performances at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles. Sybil is also an associate professor at USC in the School of Dramatic Arts. Maureen Weiss is a performance designer who has worked in all aspects of theater and design for the past 25 years. Her work has been seen internationally and was honored at the Prague Quadrennial in 2023, where she was part of a panel of female set designers. She is the co-author of a book with Sybil Wickersheimer on contemporary scenic design in the United States. She was an associate professor of performance design at Alfred University before coming to Los Angeles City College in fall 2023. As an educator, it is her goal to emphasize the importance of the visual world for new and upcoming theater practitioners. She also curates the Pop Wagon, a mobile theater truck in Los Angeles. Regina Garcia is a Puerto Rican scenic designer based in Chicago. She has had longstanding relationships with the Latinx theater's renowned teatros, including Teatro Vista, Pregones Theater, and Repertorio Español. Upcoming collaborations include American Players Theater in Wisconsin and the Guthrie Theater. Regina is a fellow of the NEA TCG Career Development Program for Designers and the Princess Grace Awards USA. She teaches at the Theater School DePaul University and is a founding member of La Gente, the Latinx Latine Theater Production Network. Please welcome to the show Sybil, Maureen, and Regina. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, you are welcome. My pleasure. I'm so excited to talk to all of you today because it's a little bit different. I usually talk to playwrights. But when I heard about your book and the about talking with scenic designers and mostly women and you know, just being a woman in the arts is a challenge. And so I'm always happy to give voice to those kinds of topics. So to dive right in, I always start at the very beginning, and my first question for all of you is, what is your first theater memory? I'll start with Maureen.
I mean, it usually goes back to, I was like privileged enough, my dad would get tickets to all the musicals, and it was during the early 80s, so my first real pungent image is we saw Dreamgirls. And it was the Jennifer Holliday Dreamgirls. And I was like, oh my God. I thought my world totally shifted within the watching of it. But we got in the car and it was playing on the radio. And I was like, oh my God. Oh my God, dad. Mm. And it was like, he looked at me and he said, I bought this, the tape. You know, like, I just thought like, oh my God, the theater followed me out. And so because it was such like a brain shift, like I could hear this world and bring it with me, was like, oh, I can continue to carry theater out in the world from that experience onward. Like it, I thought like the change doesn't have to leave when I leave that room. So Dreamgirls, Jennifer Holliday.
I love it. Sybil, how about you?
Well, I toyed at trying to decide between a personal memory of working on a show, you know, like backstage in high school or middle school, and then the first time that I actually had a transformational experience in the theater in the professional world, you know, and I think I would like to sort of lean into that, which was walking into a production at June Loon Theater in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I think because you are in the Twin Cities today, I think that was just a reason to go with that answer. June Loon, they were doing The Miser, and it was Ricardo Hernandez had designed the set. And I had sort of escaped a family function in very, like, you know, a lot of weather was happening. And I sort of excused myself from a family event that was related to my brother-in-law's wedding. But I was in town that week, and I really wanted to go and see the work at June Loon because I'd heard so much about them. And I walked, so I took a cab there on my own, and I couldn't quite tell where to go. And then I walked into the theater, and it was from the back. You entered and you saw the back of the set. And it intrigued me so much. And it was so lovely. And then you walk through and around and take your seat. And the entire production was so beautiful and so meaningful at how they used the set to tell the story and to heighten the character of the miser. So I remember that the first 20 minutes had no dialogue. So that was all added because obviously the play has dialogue when it starts. And you saw the miser poke with a stick, this tarp with water in it, holding it like it had rained and there was a hole, and he dumped the water out into a bathtub on the stage and then took a bath in it. And he went around and he collected little bits that had fallen because the house was falling apart and wrapped them up and put them on the mantle, you know, and all these things. And I was like, what is he doing? You know? And then the play started and it really just, I had chills. I had goosebumps the whole time. It was such an amazing experience. I was so glad that I had just excused myself for the evening to go and do that on my own. And I was really glad that I saw it on my own because I could really focus on what was happening in a different way.
So. What year was that? Because I may have seen that production or a remount of it.
Yeah, I think it was 2004. Five.
Yeah. I saw that production with Stephen Epp is the miser.
Yeah.
And yeah, I love June Loon.
Crazy.
When I graduated from college, I was like, I want to move to the Twin Cities and like work there because I thought that their art was just spectacular. And then the company had folded by the time I had graduated. And so I didn't get to work for them.
I was working with the Actors Gang at the time on Tartuffe. And so I had already always sort of, felt tepid about the plays. And I just, that experience working both in a physical way with the Actors Gang on Tartuffe and then seeing that very design-driven character methodology was just really exciting. So,
yeah. Fabulous.
Really deep.
Regina, what is your first theater memory?
I like Sybil, I was thinking about those initial memories and things that moments that were transformative. And I grew up in Puerto Rico, and I will say that like any other child in the island, you're always kind of geared towards performance more than design and technology. So I would say my first memory of theater is being in a leotard as one of the little rats in Thumbelina, which is unfortunate. I was the orange mouse or the little baby rat, which was awesome because to this day, orange is my favorite color, FYI. But I would say the most transformative after that, there were like, I can say that it's like a 1, 2, 3. Number two is cutting little petals. My mom was a working mother and my dad had a job, lawyer. Everybody worked 9 to 5, 9 to 6, whatever. So my mom always was looking for places to dump us, I guess, to park us for a couple of hours to help. And so she heard through friends that they needed people to help with props at the opera. So my second memory was cutting petals for 3 hours for Cavalleria Rusticana, which was the most boring job in the whole world. Because we were in a tiny room, my sister and I, just cutting little crepe out of crepe paper. I think it was white, pink, and red. And it was just, you know, 3 hours of that is not fun at any age. And then the third one, I think I was as an audience member in my year abroad while I was in college. I had the pleasure and the privilege of seeing one of Franco Zeffirelli's productions in Florence. It was a touring version of Six Characters in Search of an Author. And I did not know Italian. Of course, I was always using Spanish as a crutch. But what unfolded on stage was so just ridiculously inspiring and just moving and compelling. And I had no idea it was going to be so, for lack of a better word, theatrical, because I walked into the theater and it looked like a rehearsal space to me. I was like, oops, okay, there's no set in this show. You know, what did I know at the time? And then slowly the show started and it just kept just expanding and collapsing into itself. And there were these gorgeous moments of just real beauty and passion. And so I would say that those are my like three memories. And after that third one, it was like, ooh, maybe I should check out theater. Wink, wink. Mm-hmm. As a real life, what I want to do with my art making.
Mm. That's so great. So how did you all decide to make a career in theater? What did that path look like for you? And how did you all land in scenic design? I'll start with Regina this time.
Oh my God. I'll just say that as a fine artist, there is something about a performer or a body kind of engaging with your work that is thrilling and unique, and it can be a variety of things. I mean, it just never gets old, never gets boring. It speaks to a time and a place and a group of people and a group of variables and situations, and it's just such a great way to just look at what we do, right? That it's not just about the work, but it's about the moment of us together in a space. And I think that was what keeps me in theater, what inspired me about the work as I understood it, slowly but surely, not just making sets that would stand by themselves quietly in the back, decorated and colorful, dot, dot, dot. And I think one of the first invitations that I got to play with a group of people coming from Pregones also at school, I think I had a friend that needed a set for a thesis project. I think those moments were kind of inspired. And, you know, there is such a thing as the universe sending you messages. It's up to you to listen. And I think since Italy, the universe was saying, hey, maybe you should come try this route. But I will say that Pregones really made it clear to me that it was the right combination of art making and engagement with the community. And with that comes advocacy. And that was the right combination for me. And now that I'm a professor, that is also something that other folks have modeled for me all my life. So it just feels like it's a very kind of complete life. But yeah, it took time. Like I'm sure for everybody else on this call, it is not an easy life. And I don't care. I don't necessarily want to kind of make it, let's say, I will say it's kind of a calling. going back to the universe sending you messages, because it is difficult, it is challenging. It comes with its own series of obstacles. Some of them, like you mentioned earlier, today we're going to talk about perhaps some of them that are about gender and about region, and it's about all sorts of other things, and having access is not always a given. So it took time. But I would say it is, it was a calling, and there is that perfect combination. Like Sybil says in the book, it's about activism and advocacy and about collective memory making and all that fun stuff that is so special to what we do.
Mm. Sybil, what did your career path to being a scenic designer look like?
It kind of chose me in some ways, and it was a little, circuitous, but I think merging the maker and then merging the activist brain. I had always thought I would go into poli-sci and started college as a poli-sci major. But in high school, I was on the student senate, and my brother who's younger, became the president of the student senate eventually. And I couldn't take it anymore. But he always would tell me, could you be a little less loud at the meeting? Cause I would always speak up and talk about the challenges and the actual issues, if there are any in high school. And so I dropped that element. And then I always was an advocate for looking at politics and who is coming up in the world and in elections. And I don't know why I was always interested in that, and always sort of argumentatively kind of debating between friends and family. And so then merge that with the maker. I remember my mom saying I would just pick up tools, and I would never wait for anyone to show me. I would just start making things, and ended up having, instead of doing the babysitting route, which I hated to make money, I started working at a bead shop and started teaching classes and jewelry making, and, would make things instead to do a job after school. So that, I think, just frames me, but my parents are, one is a structural engineer and architect. The other was a trained architect, never practicing. That interest in the arts, we always went to concerts, classical concerts, because I lived in a university town. And so I was exposed to a lot of the arts without the push into theater. So when I started to do theater, I actually thought that I would go into stage management and directing. And lo and behold, how did I know that actually set design is a lot of directing? And I remember a faculty member, Bruce Bergner, my undergrad faculty member, said, you need to take this set design class. And I did. And it was within the first 2 weeks, I was like, oh, this is what I should be doing. And I instinctually was able to build the models and just do the things. And so I ended up going to graduate school thinking that I could do television, theater, and film, which is what UCLA's School of Theater, Film, and Television is, and thinking, okay, well, that's a good path because it's in the arts and I've heard it's difficult, and, maybe I can structure my life so I could design many types of things and that therefore lift up a career. But again, it's a much bigger challenge than it turns out that the words mean. And so I really pulled back after graduate school, and I didn't design scenery for several years. I learned how to be an animator, got a job. It's all about feeding yourself, but also, and paying your bills, but then how do you do this work, right? And that's sort of there's a huge conversation always about that. So I then started teaching, and I think a little felt like a novice. I'm teaching set design skills at the university level because I have an MFA, but I'm really not experienced because I'm actually working in a different area. I slowly, through the excitement of projects, and I think this is where we all live, where the excitement of the new project and the generation of ideas specific to that project and going into the depths of research that it's required to support those storylines or the points that the metaphors that are brought up in those projects, that's the exciting part. So for me, that was where I found, oh, I can actually be an advocate for plays that are about things that showcase life and make statements and make bold statements rather than just working on my own as an artist, kind of exploring with really materials more than concepts and put those together as a maker. And so I would start to talk to somebody and I would start doing these small set designs while I was working, you know, as an animator. And that brought me back into set design. So I've always been a person who is very excitable about a new project and ideas, especially if they fall into the category of bringing up challenges in our world, exposing harms, you know, all of those things. And they're not often the funny comedy plays. They're not often the musicals, you know, I do get to do some of those. But I think that feels like me. I want to make sure that that the work that I make is meaningful in that way. And so I think I definitely gravitate to pushing those two elements together, the maker and the advocate.
Is that how you choose your project, Sybil?
I don't know if it's as much a pinpoint of like, yes, I'll do that because that fits the merger. But I think those projects find me. Do you know what I mean? And so currently working on this other exhibition at the Natural History Museum, which is called Sacrifice Zone, which is an environmental justice project that's both an exhibition and a performance. That, through several years ago, finding that as a small nugget as it got started, it really interested me. And so I supported it with students, and then it grew into a bigger project. And similarly, finding during the pandemic, finding theaters not producing work, and reaching out to a friend who has a women's clinic, who is an executive director of Open Paths Counseling Center for Women in Inglewood, and saying, so if I have designers who want to design a space, what do you need? And then that's what started our Peace Pods project, which is reflection spaces for women who are about to go in and out, and when they come out of therapy, so that they have a moment to acclimate between the real world and their therapy sessions. And that's really been a long, also, you know, the projects grow when they have significance, right? And so I've been able to use the interest that I have, and just, I don't know, I think they find me, or I find them, those projects. Yeah,
I love that. Maureen, what did your career path to scenic design look like?
Well, I'm learning a lot, even though I think I know Sybil a lot. I didn't know about the jewelry making. But I can really see this through line with the politics for you. And also, I've known about the background in fine arts for Regina. But the way that Regina sees things, I now like experiences the world and how that would have pushed her into theater. I can see that. So for me, it's like, I always was interested in theater. I think I didn't know what my place was going to be in theater. I think the collaboration for me, I'm fascinated by it because I've never been, like, my first report card was like, does not play well with others. It's no joke. I got an N in that. And I think maybe that challenged me to say, I really can play well with others. So I've spent my whole life kind of just figuring out how to play and listen to others. And the thing that continues to challenge that the most is theater. I go into various worlds. I can create like really interesting pieces by myself, but I'm really finding that I don't really want to isolate. Like, I really need to learn from others. Like, that's my goal. And theater puts me in the position to have to stop and think about others. Like, it just forces me. And it's good to have, like, I feel lucky that the career that I have is always that. Like, whether I'm teaching or I'm in a theater space, I'm always having to stop myself from speaking and saying, as my mom would say, you need to think before you speak, Maureen. So this interview is great for me. but yeah, so I think it's my curiosity about people is continually challenged by this. Now, the visual part came really late for me. It wasn't early. I had to move from acting to directing to then as a director, I was like, well, I'll just start creating my own visual worlds because I didn't know who to ask to do that. So I started doing it, and it was the first thing that said they'll pay me to do it. Like, so people heard of my work and they would pay me to design. So in my head, I was like, oh, this is a career because people want to pay me. Now, you got to watch out because when you're a young, you know, after you graduated from college, you think what they're paying is good, right? But it doesn't advance beyond that. So figuring out what that career was took a while. Like, oh, well, I couldn't really have a career unless I went to grad school and could teach. And then the amount of money they pay me to design is just this little supplement. It wasn't a living. Once you get older, like if you want to do more than pay a really bad rent with 5 roommates, you know, that design. So, yes. So I sort of like expanded what this career looked like as I've aged. And I've taken on different forms of what it means to be a designer.
I love that. I would love to define some terms for myself and the audience. Scenic designer, set designer, scenographer. What is the difference? Are these interchangeable? Sybil, can you answer that for me?
Oh my. I engage with this conversation with my students a lot because scenographer is a word that is very academic in some ways and yet very exciting because it's probably more describes what we do. Right? When we take the term scenographer is that it's a design for all areas of the production and that we are merging concept and design and artistic skill to one area. Whereas set designer seems like you're just designing the set and that's it. You know what I mean? And in television and film, a set designer is actually the draftsman. So, I prefer the word set designer, but I don't know that it matters. I'm not sure. I think I like it because it's short and my name is really long.
Fair. Well, I'd love to jump right into talking about the Scene Shift book, and the origin and impetus for it. Maureen, will you talk about your professional relationship with Sybil and how you came together to do this project?
I don't know if it was professional relationship. Sybil actually came and taught while I was in grad school. And so we started a relationship in that way. And then I eventually went on and I was teaching at Loyola Marymount University and was approached by Routledge about writing a book about set design. And so I had a meeting with Routledge and it was going to be like later in the day and I had meetings with students and right before they just wanted me to come up with an idea for a book about set design. And I was like, oh my gosh. So I had like all these very weird ideas. Like I thought they were like fascinating ideas, but they were pretty like, they weren't pinpointed. I was meeting with a student right before it. And she was a woman. And she said, I just don't see a career path for women in set design. And I was like, I haven't been doing this right. And I really, it hit me and I said, okay, let's talk. And she wanted to see, you know, the names of the Tony winners. She wanted to see all of them and she hadn't seen them. They just weren't out there. So I was like, okay, well, I think we need a book. So I went to that meeting and I said, maybe it's about, you know, women in scenic design. I didn't know. I wasn't that sure. But once they said, oh, that was like, they were like, yes, yes. And then I got scared and I was like, I can't do this. So I called Sybil and I said, here's this. They really want us to write a book or they want me to, but I will not do this alone. And what do you think of this idea? And we had like amazing discussions about should it be a women in set design book? and this decision that it's really not about that title. And it's not about that. It's about looking at different career paths and people that are trying to sort of change what set design kind of looks like. And it just so happened, you know, we had compiled lists through our years to share in classes of women who were set designers and several non-binary. And then, but Sybil came up with the brilliant part of it, which is, look, we were trained with one set design book. Well, it eventually became two, but American Set Designers by Arnold Aronson. And in that book, there are, the first one is one woman. And I think the second
13.
Yeah.
Design.
Yeah. So we just decided to flip that paradigm in our book so that we would sort of like switch it gender wise. I don't know if you want to speak about that, Sybil, and what you thought when I confronted you with the idea of the book.
Well, I'm interested to know, is that your experience, Regina, that you had those two books?
Yeah,
as guides? Right?
Absolutely. I had those two books, even through the TCG fellowship and everything. They always kind of just give you those two books.
Those are the only two that I knew of.
Yeah. I was always looking for women scenic designers. So I was most definitely up my chairs back about how many plays written by women we were doing, about how many women faculty we had on, you know, so it was all kind of connected. At the time I used to send faxes in the middle of the night from my computer to her desk. But yeah, those two books were it.
And so in each of those books, there's 13 designers that are focused on, there's one female. And so we started with the idea of, well, let's just flip it. Let's consider, does it mean American Set Design 3 is what we want to write? And let's, you know, invite one male and 12, you know, designers. But then when we started to put the lists together of who we were excited by and do the research of who else is out there, it just kept growing. And so that's where we ended up with 30. And then finally, I mean, there's so many more, luckily, and, you know, fantastically, but we had to make a cut. So we really, you know, people have asked us, how did we come to that group? And honestly, they were the designers that we were excited by, you know? I mean, and I think you have to curate in some way, putting a group together. And we were reading the Priya Pritzker book, How to Gather, is that the name of it? She has some really wonderful discussions about how you limit the group, right? And who is invited, which is a really hard thing for us because we wanted to make it as open as possible. And yet, you know, we just couldn't go, there was just so much communication with 30 people. So, it was a challenge to go down that path, and it kept us busy in communication for a long time.
In the process, I will say that we found like a real yin and yang. So it's like, I'll jump into a project, but I needed Sybil to take me back so that we had these hard conversations every step as we move forward. And then there are moments where it's like, you know, I'm like, okay, so we got to push it because they're never like, we'll never not want to keep editing this book. Like we could have honed that more and more, but we, you know, so it was nice. It like me reaching out, like that was the smartest thing I've done in many, many years was to say, I can't do this myself.
Hmm. And Regina, how did you get involved with the conversations and the project that became the book?
Well, I would say that these two designers are wonderful at gathering people. And I was working at the time at Oregon Shakespeare Festival. And one of the wonderful things about OSF at the time was that you could have multiple shows either in tech or designer run or actually opening for performance to the public. So Sybil and I were there at the same time working in two different theaters. And we were able to have lunch. It's like, hey, I've been meaning to talk to you about this. And she brought it up casually at our dinner. And I was like, yeah, sure, absolutely. It was, she planted the seed for what was to come.
Yeah, that's great. So in the book, which I have right here, I have it. In the book, there are conversations about speaking up for yourself, the lack of money in the arts, the need to be working multiple jobs at once, and training the next generation of designers. What conversations are you having with your students and young designers now that you were not having pre-pandemic? We'll start with Maureen.
Well, I think I've become braver in my ability to have conversations with my students and to be more honest, because our world expanded. When you had us all in the room, we could all confirm that we're not being paid correctly. We could confirm these things. It took till our last conversation for us to be honest with each other and say, are you making a living at this? And when you're on a call with the top designers that you know, and they're not making a living at it, that was a shocking moment. So hearing that meant I couldn't go back into the classroom without, sharing that, some of that knowledge. But that's not easy, because they're paying money to get a degree in something that the career out there is going to maybe not pay you back monetarily in the way you're going to need. So I'm pretty upfront with that. But I tell them the ways that they can make a career in it and what that looks like. It just might not look like a singular, you're going to get a job that's going to pay you and you're going to be on Broadway. Like that, even that doesn't mean that you're sustainable. The way that you sustain yourself is going to be through multiple methods. And I've taught long enough to see which of my students have sort of created new modalities to having a life in theater and doing it in a way that's healthier. So I feel grateful for that. I've sort of, I cobbled together what I call like a sustainable existence in the theater, but I'm still challenged by it. And I don't hide it from the students. Like there's no way to hide it. Before, I think I was hiding it. I still say we all need to wear our salaries on our shirt, like everywhere we go.
Mm. Yeah. Sybil, how about you? What conversations are you having with your students now?
Very similar. I think there's a lot of work. So I usually start with saying, don't worry, because that's the question I get asked a lot is, can I make a living? And parents with their children entering into college. And so there's a lot of work, and it doesn't mean that you'll be a set designer for theater. It might mean you're a set designer for many other formats of media that take place right now. And that is, equally exciting, and you might put all of those together in a different way. But I think we're all learning from seeing designers who have created companies. And I never knew that that was a path that I could do. And I need to embrace it. And I think in the next version of myself, if that's possible, I think we need to come together in teams and create a company so that we can take bigger projects and sustain ourselves in a different way, because I can't do the job of a bunch of different people, but maybe I can if we bring set designers together, especially if they're at different stages of their career. So I don't know. I think that I've seen successful men doing that, male designers. And I don't know necessarily why I was never taught that that was a possibility, and have sort of slowly realized that I should have taken a business class.
Regina, what conversations are you having with your students that you weren't having pre-pandemic?
Yeah, I think similarly to my colleagues, we talk a lot about sustainability of our practice, and we talk a lot about diversifying. Mm-hmm. Most definitely. I mean, I think I still have some of those students that just cannot see themselves in other areas, just theater. And I just said, hey, design is going to take you in a variety of, to different places, and you want to be flexible and nimble. And that's the name of the game, flexibility and nimbleness. And what we have right now is all sorts of projects that are hybrids. Mm-hmm. And you want to be ready for those jobs. You want to be ready knowing that software. You want to be ready to play and to learn and to keep on learning. So we have, I think the big conversation, especially after the pandemic, is most definitely in terms of hours of work. That's become very apparent. I think my students want to know, you know, how many hours do I need to work on this project? How many hours will it take me to revise it? Can I go to bed at 11? Because I go to bed at 11, or I go to bed at 10 o'clock. And I was like, well, there are ways that you can compartmentalize your homework, maybe. But in terms of developing a practice and a way that of dealing with projects, I think you're going to have to really think about what's going to be sustainable for you and your life, the life that you want. Because it's most definitely still challenging. Even after the pandemic, we had so many conversations about oppressive practices and things that, especially on the side of the on the women, things that we had to kind of manage to survive or to kind of make it up across that finish line. And you know, some of the theaters and producers that we're dealing with right now are still, you know, they're all just going back to, you know, the default is the default. And when people are afraid of butts in seats, not having enough butts in seats, not having a confirmation that there's going to be a money back. And we have all these positions that have not been filled in resident theaters across the country. The default is exclusionary. The default is, like I was talking with this with one of my costume designer friends. It was like, they're doing bigger shows, Regina. They're doing bigger shows, and they're not paying me to do the bigger shows. There are more changes in costumes. They want those butts in seats. They're huge musicals that haven't been done in 30 or 40 years. But they need to bring those bodies back into the house. And like, I get it, but it's just, it's not lining up. When you present that to the students, they're worried and they get defensive and why not? And of course we want to be champions for our field and for where it could potentially go and grow to, especially after this moment of reflection and reckoning, but this period of reckoning and reflection, but it's hard to be a champion when the information from our friends and colleagues is still coming back as, this is not getting better. It is not. Sybil, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I have one other thing that, you know, I realize that I do with my students is I think that type of conversation is very difficult to have because they don't have the experience to reflect back on what that means. And so one of the biggest things I've noticed is helpful after the pandemic is really breaking everything into smaller pieces. So for example, saying, well, you know, set designers, as we, it's a lot of work to turn in all of the deliverables for a package for a set. So, you know, step back, let's just make a little timeline and a schedule. Let's do one thing today, one thing tomorrow, right? And break it down so you don't get so stressed out that you're looking ahead and going, oh, I can't do that, right? And it kind of, it's similar for budgeting, for contracting, for everything. And so I've been trying to take, like, I think Maureen said it just recently, that just taking a step back and saying, well, let's just, instead of trying to say, I'm going to assign you to do this set design. Instead, actually, yes, I'm assigning you to do that, but instead I'm assigning you 10 steps that will then actually achieve that, and breaking it down week by week or day by day. And the students that I've had, when they start to spiral a little bit out of control, but either professionally or just about the day to day, I kind of take that same approach and say, well, tell me about your schedule today. Let's find one thing we can do that you can check off today.
And I think the reason I was sort of breaking it down for students is because sometimes we do more work on the design than we're paid for or there's time allotted for. Like, actually look at what we're turning in and tell them, like, break it down, because we do turn in pages and pages of information. And so if we're not paid before that, we need to make a decision on how much we're going to turn in during the project, right? I'm going to give you this and I'm going to give you this, but you're then not going to get a model. So monetize each of those things. And so I think I'm sort of teaching that to myself and my students at the same time. Like, you kind of negotiate what you're turning in based on the salary, because it's a lot of turning in and there's no way my hours account to what I'm getting paid for, because we're up all hours on changes.
Yeah. And it sounds like these conversations you all are having are not just applicable to set designers, it's applicable to all areas of theater and other industries as well. So it's really important. Sybil, in the book, you mention being an activist. Talk to me about how activism comes into play for you as a scenic designer.
Well, gosh, in each project is different, but I will say that it gives a visual voice to maybe moral issues, to challenges of the human race. You know, like, we get to visualize that in a way that the performers bring it to life. And so for me, I do always feel like there's a bit of that voice of the whole project or the through line of the project. Like, what do you want the audience to take away from this project? I can design to that, right? And I would say that that may not be what the audience walks away thinking, well, I think that was about that, you know, but there ultimately it's a subtle thing, and it's, you're asking the audience to come and embrace something that they may not have been aware of or that they're exposed to. So that's my way in to feeling like I'm doing something as an activist in my work as a theater artist.
I love that. Maureen, you talk about in the book, you talk about how when you need the okay from a director, you approach men and women directors differently, and you tend to be more direct with women. Why do you think this is? And does it also depend on the experience level of the director?
I will say that, you know, as the editors of this book, that was a conversation that I was like, are we going to put that conversation in? I don't know, because really we started out wondering about this, Sybil and I, like, are we dealing with each other differently based on gender in any way? Like, or are our designs different because we're women? Do they feel different because we're not getting hired for things? You know, we had a lot of these conversations. So then when that came up in one of our conversations with the other designers, we did keep it in, but I'm always fluctuating on my answer there. I do think that there's an equality with another woman in a collaboration that allows me to not feel like I need to say it in a different way. Like, I need to get a change made in a different way. Like, I can be an equal and say, listen, you know, we're disagreeing on this. Whereas possibly, and I don't even know if this is true, but possibly sometimes when I'm working with men, I wouldn't say it that way. I would actually try to make it their idea. You know, a lot more. But I don't know. I mean, I have, like, right now, I'm working with Jose Luis Valenzuela from the Latina Theater Company in Los Angeles. And I would say that, like, that doesn't, I can be very direct with him, you know, so it's definitely not the same there. So there are a lot of exceptions to this.
That's so interesting. Regina, in the book, you mentioned the difference between a theater and an installation. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Thank you for the question. What I would say is that the, just like a dancer in space, an installation is already performing a thought, an idea, a concept. It is the beginning, middle, and end of a creative thought. And it lives by itself in space. And it has a, usually, often, a conversation, a dialogue with the space it lives in. What we do is similar, but it vibrates with potential, waiting for the performer to step in. It is only when the performer steps in that it is complete.
Oof. I love that so much.
I know.
Wow.
I want that soundbite.
So good.
So good.
That's going to be my soundbite. I'll send it to all of you.
Oh my God. It's a hard one. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Will you keep talking about it?
Oh,
what's your experience with installation? How did you come to that feeling?
I just think that in terms of my engagement with the art, I'm always kind of aware of space, and I think it came from those foundation years of me trying to decide where I was gonna do my thing, or because I had this urgency to make stuff too, but I wasn't savvy on the skill side, and installation art kind of came in as an option early because I was a sculptor and a painter, but I was just looking for a different kind of fulfillment in terms of like what Maureen was saying regarding collaboration and engagement with the performing body, like the body in space demands a different for us to consider different variables. So I think in my conversations in with my colleagues and all that now, in terms of what feels complete and what is a design done where you can present it, because we were talking about it and it's connected most definitely to the business side of our practice. What is it done so that we can that we can move forward? I just think like look at the design, at the sketch, and it feels like the possibilities are there, that it's a pendulum, right? It's a pendulum, and in that brief moment, it's just like in the middle, mm-hmm. like what it doesn't want to be. That's when it's done. You send it to the director. And then you can bullet point the possibilities, the pros and the cons, or the pros and the shortcomings. I kind of try to lead into that part of the process early so that we're considering all possibilities and then making an informed decision on how to move forward.
There's so much there. There's so much, Regina. I mean, Sybil and I are having a lot of conversations about space right now because we're going to be writing sort of an article about how we look at space. But this idea of this middle of the pendulum, you're saying, when to walk away, when it's done, is really fascinating. Like I was speaking to Abigail DeVille when she was installing, and I was like, I told her that I had been working on a piece that's going to go in the gallery. And I said, but I left it over break. And I don't even want to think about how I left it. It horrifies me. And Abigail goes, sounds like it's in the perfect place. And I was like, oh my God, I'll take it. Like, you're right. Like that moment is really hard as a designer. Like that you're like, but I know that there's a part of what we do, which is we have to throw things out to an audience. Right. And we can't, and it's theater, and we want theater to enact emotion. And so we need a little of that in all of our work. We need some of that there that's left over. Like we can't hone all the edges. And we can't. We literally cannot, because we will get asked to hone more and more edges as we keep going.
Maureen, talk to me about motherhood and being a scenic designer.
So I was telling at one point in my career, someone said, don't mention you're a mom.
Oof.
So I put that on everything because I'm like, I'm going to mention it. I'm going to keep Good putting it out there because there's no way that it's not why I do what I do. But it's also makes what I do, you know, really not always easy. Like the theater hours are not helpful to being a mom, but also I just like having conversations about motherhood, and I don't want anybody telling me that I can't, or I can't bring my kids to the sets, or like I think it's important that they're around what we do. So
so Regina and Sybil, are either of you mothers, and do you have opinions you want to add to this conversation?
I am not a mom. I am not a mom, but I support children being in the space.
That's nice to hear. I am a mom. I have two kids. I've been bringing them with me for years now, and I get various responses. When I travel, it's often been amazing, and it's super hard because I'm always very tired when I'm doing that. But it brings them to different places, and so they get to then also see what I do, and they know it intrinsically. I'm about to bring my son to DC this weekend, and you know, and they also they kind of love being in places where they're expected to be more mature and things are happening around them, like bad words and like, you know, things that they might be sheltered from in a different environment. And I remember my daughter at Richard II, one of the actors is like showing her how the stage violence was staged, you know? And so, yeah, she was like completely fine with it. And she's like five, you know? And you'd think that, kids aren't able to take that in, but you know, I've seen her, she went to the opening with me of Richard II at 5 or 6, like, you know, and she loved it. And you know, her, the response was that when I ask them about the plays that, and what they mean, they're picking it up. They're picking up, you know, I did make a mistake of bringing Otto to Aaron Posner, The Heel, which is, I didn't realize, we went to visit a friend, Erica Chong, Chuk, I'm probably just butchered her last name, who is a choreographer, and she's working at the Getty Villa with Aaron. And we went to the Getty Villa, we walked around, we had fun having dinner with the actors. And then they said, stay for the show. It's only an hour. It's really great. And so we stayed. Every other word is motherfucker. And Otto was, I think he's also similarly like 6 or 7. And we're sitting in the amphitheater and he turned around and he was like, this is so good. And he was like, every time they'd curse, he'd turn around because he was sitting right in front of me and give me a high five. It was hilarious. But afterwards, he knew that he followed the story completely. So, you know, the language then becomes, I feel like I'm either the best mom ever or the worst mom ever when I talk to them about that. Because I do have to sometimes ignore them while they're with me. But the, I don't know, I love it. I love the fact that I can expose them to that. So I feel it as a, lucky as an artist to be able to do that, at least as long as they'll let me.
I guess, but yeah. Tech Week still gets my kids. Like, they're still like, it's traumatized them for sure. Like, they're just like, oh no, it's, and I keep thinking they're going to age out of it. But it doesn't change. Like, it's a lot for kids to know that your mom is like going to be stressed about something for a good week and a half. Yeah. So they always are like, oh God, not tech week. I know.
Well, mine are like, oh God, tech. Is that where, that's when you like repeat everything over and over again, right? Yeah. I'll stay home now that they're older. It's like, yeah. I get it.
So I want to talk about the exhibit you have opening in February. Sybil, tell the people what it's about, your part in it, and when and where it's happening.
So Scene Shift, the exhibit, is taking place at the USC Fisher Museum of Art. And it is a museum that is separate from the campus, but also on the campus. USC also now runs the Pacific Asia Museum, which is in Pasadena, also not on the campus, but they're both really remarkable museums, and the idea of bringing it to life as an exhibit at first seemed a welcome idea to share what we do as set designers and educate the audiences about what set designers do. And in fact, it sort of educated us about the boundaries between art and installing a work of art, which, because we as set designers, often our work is destroyed, is very challenging to do in a museum setting. So we actually have had to go to the different artists who we wanted to bring their work in. And really, we've kind of opened it up, like, who wants to show work? who has something to show that you've kept from work, you know, at a theater. And then we only got sort of tepid response. So we kind of went to our designers and said, so for example, for Regina, you know, we would love to show this image that you created and bring it to life in a way that maybe wasn't exactly how it was shown in the set and make it an art object, right? And so we've done that with a few different designers. It's been a really interesting conversation, and we're, I think right now, working through what does it mean to own the work as an art object, show the work as an object that feels meaningful, and open, like release it from the set that it was a part of originally and from the production, and look at it in a different way.
Yeah, that's good, Sybil.
Yeah, Regina, will you talk to us in just in response to that about the way we approached you about your piece, and will you just discuss the background behind that drawing image?
Sure. I was very excited to hear from Maureen and Sybil, and especially for that they were interested in showing a portion of the overall design for American Mariachi at the Denver Center, where we premiered it some years back. And in particular, this image of one of the murals memorializing a community member that was part of the larger composite of murals for the piece. And in this particular case, it was the I selected a portrait of one of the, let's call them muses for the playwright, one of the women that really inspired the story for the playwright, and he dedicates the piece to them. I definitely went back to the family who lent me the original portrait. Asked permission, of course, to make sure that we could continue to celebrate her in a variety of ways. And this part of the museum, I sent Sybil and Maureen statement and all that, and they were just floored. She was part of the very much a community activist and an extended family of the Valdez of Teatro Campesino, and she's very much a mom and an aunt to dear friends, Kinan Valdez and Mino, and who's a composer and sound. So we had to celebrate our ancestors. Anyway, they were very excited. I think placement within the exhibit and how the audience, Maureen and Sybil called me to just kind of take a quick look just to get my feedback on how it would sit within the exhibit, how would people kind of walk in and kind of engage with this first, then this, and make their way to the extra large rendering of this portrait. And I think we had a wonderful conversation about the work, and you know, I think I'm sure with everybody else of how, you know, sitting within the space, but also sitting next to one another, we could kind of let's say uplift its initial meaning and why it was made in the first place and why that choice. So by sitting together, these pieces also kind of inform one another in terms of their role in the original piece, but also in the celebration.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And so the exhibit is opening at the Fisher Museum on February 2nd. How long does it run?
Until April 6th.
Okay, mm-hmm. So I'll have that info in the show notes. So if you're in the LA area, check that out. Go see it. So this is 101 stage adaptations. What are some of your favorite stage adaptations? We'll start with Maureen.
Oh, goodness. There's a lot. I've seen a lot of theater, but the one that always sticks out, I often reference it was the Anne Bogart, Anne Hamilton, Theater is a Blank Page? I think it's Theater is a Blank Page or Theater is a Blank Stage, but one or the other. Did any of you see that one? And it was like, yeah, it's amazing. You walk into, it was at UCLA, and you walked in and the whole audience was covered with a sheet, like all the chairs. And there were just three rows of us in that huge theater. I think it was Royce Hall. Everything was covered. And you sat in these rows and you just watched a person on the stage typing. And I think it was Anne Hamilton. And then you were led onto the stage and it was all blank pages. Everything was just a blank page. And then you, as part of the audience, were you, it was all lines from To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf. And it was just like, it just like you became part of it. You went on stage, you were weaving stuff. It was the most gorgeous adaptation of anything I've ever seen. And I've run into like several people where we've had this in common, that we saw this show. It's like one of those shows where you're like, you saw that? You were able to see that? And it will never leave me. So yeah, that one, I think. Yeah.
Oh, I love that. Regina, what are some of your favorite stage adaptations?
I would say... not to continue the Anne Bogart love, but maybe I would say for City, Gatsby and its iterations and the exhibit at the Prague Quadrennial in 2011, I believe. It's similar to what I think Scene Shift is doing continuing to do in terms of the seeing its iterations, it was just very exciting. I also just in terms of celebrating our godfather and godmother of the Latinx theater and La Gente in particular. I am a sucker for anything by Luis Alfaro or Karen Zacarias, and I know Karen has a couple of adaptations out there right now, and I'm just very excited for that work.
Yeah. What about you, Sybil?
Well, I would love to say that continuing the Anne Bogart love is always a good idea. And I did see that piece, Maureen. Yeah. Which I have a story about that, but I'll tell you later. But the, you know, they have taken many pieces of stories, as well as plays, as well as fiction, as well, you know, and reinterpreted them in a way that's very visual and physicalized. And I've always enjoyed those adaptations. Trojan Women is one that I worked on here at the Getty Villa in Los Angeles. And that was a lovely version of it. And within the Greek tragedies seem to be always on a cycle of readapting and reevaluating. And I just worked on a Metamorphosis that was really interesting and so different than the Mary Zimmerman Metamorphosis, which I had worked on a few years ago, maybe 10 years ago. And I've seen three different versions of that play, the one that was adapted by Zimmerman, one at OSF and one at Looking Glass, and, you know, I think both directed by her. Mm-hmm. And then having done it myself, as well as worked with it as a designer. That's an interesting group of stories. But this new Metamorphosis, which was written in the UK during the pandemic, it has three playwrights. And I will have to send you the names of the three playwrights because I will not remember them. But I just did that Metamorphosis in Seattle at Seattle Rep. And it is a very, very different experience. It is told from the female perspective or non-binary perspective, and it is exposing the violence of the stories in a very real way. And the stories are spectacular, and they're the same stories as Mary Zimmerman's, you know, Metamorphosis, in most of them, and just completely different. So very interesting adaptation.
Is there a pool on stage?
There is not a pool.
Adaptation?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope. So,
I'm obsessed with Metamorphoses. I saw a storefront production of it here in St. Paul, and it just broke me wide open in the best way. So
Sybil's design for that, I remember it flooded the whole, do you remember your design for Metamorphosis with the pool?
Oh, yeah,
It flooded
you were
the
there,
whole
right?
computer lab. Yeah, you did it at a university. Yeah,
I didn't flood it.
You didn't flood it, but I just remember the frickin' pool.
And Maureen, you were saying that the other portion of the design work was headed by Anne Hamilton.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The installation artist.
Awesome. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was a really cool collaboration. I'm gonna have to get Sybil's story on it.
Yeah.
But you actually got a piece like from it. So like you got a piece of art as you exited it. So that's how and I still have it. And I've run into people like my last colleague at my other university. I went into her office, and this is in New York, and she had one. So you can sort of like track each other through this like weird thing that we all kind of kept them. Yeah.
I think you should start a group on WhatsApp.
Who saw this show? There's so many shows like that I saw that I don't remember completely that I'm like, try to like figure out, like there was one where I was in like a bleacher. If anybody's seen this show, it was a Shakespeare, but it was in a warehouse, and they all of a sudden, I think I'm just sitting in the bleachers, and all of a sudden the bleachers start moving. They start pushing you around the space. Anybody? This is one. It was really cool. They moved.
Anyway,
Sybil sent me a note that says the three playwrights, Metamorphoses by Sammy Ibrahim, Laura Lomas, and Sabrina Mafouz. Apologies if I got any of those pronunciations wrong. Those are the playwrights for that adaptation. Thank you for that. I have two more theater questions for you. What is one thing you wish more playwrights knew about your job as a scenic designer? I'll start with Regina.
I think going back to the thought that it is a calling, because I would say that designers in a room with a playwright and a director, I've never seen, I mean, I've seen all sorts of variations, but when it works, it's when everybody says, yes, let's play, and are able to say, to kind of let go of things that don't work quickly and lead into the things that work. I feel like for scenic designers, I will say this, that scenic designers are the first ones up, and we have a lot more questions because we haven't started the rehearsal process, and our work usually has to be done by the time the rehearsal process begins. So there's a lot of what if that we have to kind of be okay with and it's a big responsibility, and it takes a long time to get to a place that it could be okay, right? That it's flexible enough, elastic enough, that it could handle some changes later on. But I think playwrights forget a little bit about that, about just the timeline of getting something on stage.
Mm-hmm. Maureen, what do you wish more playwrights knew about your job as a scenic designer?
I mean, I think that I want them to know that we really do take in the language. Like, it is our core. I think that it, because we don't speak in language all the time and we speak in visuals, sometimes I feel like they think we're not hearing the language, but I've come to like really trust that all these years I'm like taking this language in, like my job is to really feel this language. And I think there's a trust that I wonder about, like, we really do invest, like I'm super invested in this process. So even if it feels like left field, like it is, we hone these instincts to find this visual world of meaning, but we're listening to you first, but we hone our instincts next. And so I feel like I want you to know that, like, we really honor the voice, but we also honor our own at the same time.
That's great. Sybil, how about you?
Well, that's very nicely put. And I think the questions that we get are about, oh, well, you didn't remember about that prop or that use of something. And really, I think it's because we're focused on the overall so much, rather than maybe some of that minutia that I'm not saying it's less important. It just may not have stuck with my memory, right? That there's this thing rather than this thing. That's a small detail. So I think there's trust that, you know, we'll get to that as the performers help us to make the space activated, because we do so much of our work early. So I guess for me, I wish that that others would recognize more that our job is to watch and to look rather than to build and to paint. And, you know, often we have to rely on our eyes and watching the timing and watching the mess that we've made up there and not be held responsible to come in and make the paint treatment right or to make the thing, you know, from that, even though we know how to build and paint, that that's actually not necessarily part of the job that we've signed up to do. And I think when, if that would be more honored, then perhaps our hours would be able to be truncated a little bit, which might help with some of the other tasks, other things or challenges that come up as part of the business side.
That's great. My final theater question: if you found a magic lamp with Dionysus inside and he could grant you one theater wish, what would you wish for? Start with Maureen.
Well, I mean, there, you know, it's easy to say that I'd wish for more money in theater. Like that's a real easy one. I mean, more money, more space, yeah, and more bravery, I think. Mm.
Yes. Regina, how about you?
Yeah, I think I would ditto that just because it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. Most definitely. Sybil.
I would ask that productions plan a week of workshop about 3 or 4, maybe 6 months earlier, before the work actually needs to happen from our end, so that we could come together in a space, read the play, do a few physical activities, bring in some materials and try some ideas out with the play before having to know on your own what the set should be like and dive in without having that collaboration. And whenever that does happen, and you know, I just came from a workshop working with Jared Mazzacci on The Moderate, and then I've done many workshops with Shauna Cooper, because they're directors who advocate for workshops to happen before the production process. And it's just always beneficial, and it just means so much, and it allows us to do braver work because we're coming together and talking about it.
Mm, that's great. So the book is Scene Shift. The exhibit is at the Fisher Museum, opening February 2nd, 2024. And both of those links will be in the show notes. Sybil, what is next for you, and where can people learn more about you and your work?
Well, I have a website, and you can definitely learn about my work from that. I hope that instead you'll pick up a copy of Scene Shift, the book, because I think that to me is very exciting to learn about all of these designers, and their conversations with each other. I'm next up going to DC this weekend to put on a production of Mind Play by Vinnie DePonto and directed by Andrew Niesler at Arena Stage.
Awesome. Regina, what is next for you, and where can people learn more about you?
I have a website, and you can definitely Google me, but I am so excited to continue the work or presenting Between Two Knees around the country. Between Two Knees is a play written by the 1491s, and they are a sketch comedy troupe Native Americans, and they're an intertribal group at that. They started as a YouTube. I think they started putting movies and videos on YouTube, and slowly but surely they are indeed satirist and a very talented group of makers. And we are going to present our show at the Pearlman, at the new Pearlman down at the World Trade Center as part of their inaugural season. The piece is directed by Eric Ting, because nobody else can do this work except for Eric Ting. It's been, we originally premiered it in 2019 at OSF as part of the American Revolutions commissions. And I just wanted to put it out there because somebody has to take the helm of that initiative. Somebody, not just one theater, multiple theaters. Let's tell our stories and make a commitment to our stories. Please, 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 planting the seed, American Revolutions. I think it opens February 8th. I'm very excited to bring Between Two Knees to New York City.
That's great. Maureen, what's next for you and where can people find you online?
You can find the book and all the designers in the book. You can find them on sceneshift.com. Yes, scene-shift.com. And I have a website that you can link. But I love looking at all these designers. And it's really good if you're a professor because you can send them to this website and you can click on all those links and there's tons of great designs. I have a show opening, next week at the Latino Theater Company downtown at the Los Angeles Theater Center. And it's the American Trilogy. And I'm designing Charity, which is written by Evelina Fernandez and directed by Jose Luis Valenzuela. And it's a really great show, so people should come see it. Or if they don't, still look at this company and the work they do.
Fabulous. Sybil, Maureen, Regina, thank you so much for chatting with me today. This was so amazing. And I would encourage everybody to get the book and go to the exhibit if you are in the LA area.
And thank you, Maureen and Sybil, for this vision and this amazing book from all of us. If you haven't heard, thank you yet from all 30 of us. Well, thank you.
We're grateful for you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of 101 Stage Adaptations. If you liked it, I hope you'll forward to a friend today. Sharing is caring, and word of mouth is still the best form of advertising. So I hope you'll share it with someone today. 101 Stage Adaptations is produced by me, Melissa Schmitz, with the help of Hello Podcast Media. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next time.